Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way on Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., and we stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We archive the radio programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page, and we also link to our guests. Every week we have a different guest, and sometimes we have returning guests like today, and I'm very thrilled to have in studio with me Roberta Grimes, who has been on this program before, talking about all things, I'll be flippant anyway, all things dead. But that's not entirely true. Welcome to the program. Welcome to Santa Barbara.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Richard. Thank you for inviting me.
And you happened to make a trip to Santa Barbara to put on a presentation or a workshop. First of all, the listeners need to know that this particular workshop has come and gone. That doesn't mean that there won't be another one coming, but tell us about what it was that you were talking about over the 2 or 3 day weekend.
Well, it's really a mastermind. I've been working extensively with Steve Harrison of Bradley Communications to get a handle around taking my books to the next level, which seems to be happening pretty rapidly, so I can certainly endorse his work. And he is a very good friend of Jack Canfield's, and there's a mastermind being conducted in the next 2 days at Jack Canfield's home. I'm thrilled to go. I'm excited about the possibilities.
Mm. Well, we've been working to try to get him. Maybe you can put a good word in for me.
I certainly will.
Give it a shot.
I'll do it.
Can't hurt. I mean, we've talked about, obviously, the previous times you've been on the program, we've talked, of course, about the fun of dying, which some people would kind of wonder what that's all about. The fun of staying in touch, a little more community-minded, if you will. But then
yes,
there's also Liberating Jesus, which was also a very fun fun conversation that we had. And what I am always interested in, as I've shared before, is this whole aspect of the afterlife, if you will. And yet, all of the terminology that we use today is still very inaccurate, because there is no before life or afterlife. It's just life. You're just living, and you're either in a body or you're not in a body. And you're either in a male or a female body, or you, I suppose, could be in an animal body. We just don't know
100%. It seems that there's not reincarnation involving animals, but we certainly do switch it up between lifetimes, and we all live many lives. Coming to the earth is a lot like a bad afternoon in the gym. We can't grow spiritually in the afterlife levels, or really real life, as the people there actually call it. We can't grow spiritually there because it's like lying around on a spiritual couch. Hmm. I mean, there's no stress. There's no negativity. And if ever there were a place where there's negativity, which will stress you spiritually, it's here. Mm-hmm. So we come here with a plan to have as much negativity in our lives as possible, because that's how we grow spiritually.
And yet I'm still perplexed by the concept, because I mean, even I think as we shared in a previous program, it's like, well, but why do we think we need the negative, stressful experiences? Is the other life that boring, laying on the couch, as you euphemistically
put it? No, the other life is perfect. There's nothing but love. There's nothing but acceptance, joy, peace, fun. It's the happiest you can possibly imagine being. But the afterlife is a kind of spiritual hierarchy. At the very highest is we are pure love. At lower levels, we have some negativity. And what's negativity? The most negative energy there is fear. And all the other negativity seems to stem from fear. And by coming into a place where there is fear and all of its horrible offshoots, like mm-hmm. hatred and anger and grief, all of those things shoot out from fear. And coming to a place where we experience that helps us to strengthen our ability to love perfectly, which is what the goal is. Very much as if you would be strengthening a set of, muscles, mm-hmm. you can strengthen your spiritual muscles by having resistance applied to them.
But you can only do it in this physical world.
Because there's no negativity. It's like going to a gym that has no machines if you're living in the afterlife levels, what we still popularly call the afterlife levels. But as you wisely point out, it's real life. It's
yeah.
not there's no before and after, really. It's just all life.
Right, right. How did you get drawn into this whole room? Because this is huge. It really is. I mean, you could talk about near-death experiences, your out-of-body experiences. There are people who I've interviewed, I'm going to have on again, talking about experiences that they're having with people who have gone into the next world, and yet they're still communicating. And yet I'm sitting here thinking, well, wait a minute, what about that whole aspect of going into the light and you move on to the next level and all of these things? Why is this person still hanging around communicating with you? Doesn't this person have, or entity have, better things to do? And to hear you tell it, no, not really.
Well, no, there is a ton of stuff to do there, but love is what's paramount. And if people who have lost someone they love want to do it, they can maintain a very good relationship. It requires some effort on both sides. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine whose husband recently transitioned and is communicating with her all the time through a medium, but she told me this story just a couple of days ago. She's asked him through the medium, well, so what are you doing? She said, because I'm his wife, I thought I should know. And he said, well, mainly I'm learning how to communicate with the dead. That's how they think of us. We're the ones who are dead. He's having fun.
Well, there is a certain amount of truth to that theory. I have to agree with him. And again, when we speak in that the gender-specific aspects, it's because we're connecting with the person they were in this life, in this lifetime. But in fact, there is no male or female. Or is there?
Well, yes and no. Ultimately, we tend to tend toward being androgynous after we've stopped incarnating. While we are in the process of doing our repeated incarnations, we tend to favor one gender and then have an occasional life in the other gender. Mm-hmm. For example, I have almost always been male. This is a very different incarnation for me. And I'll go back to being male as soon as I get back to where I live.
Now, do you feel uncomfortable in this body, in this
lifetime? I did in the beginning.
Okay.
And that's why I'm so much against allowing children under the age of 18 to have surgery or do anything irrevocable or take hormones. Because I was a child who felt not at comfortable in a female body until my hormones kicked in. After that, I was fine. Mm-hmm. We've got to let children go through puberty. I think I read an article the other day that said we mustn't let children do anything irrevocable about their gender until they're 18. I would wholeheartedly second that because people choose the aspects of their lives, who will be in their lives, what the hazards, difficulties, problems, tragedies will be in those lives, and they choose their gender very specifically. I chose to be female in this life for very specific reasons, and the fact that I had so much hangover from all my male lifetimes didn't change the fact I was supposed to be female. It was part of the plan. So if we allow a child, or really encourage a child, it's a matter of helping children to be comfortable with who they are. And I happened to be a tomboy until I was, 16 or 15, and after that I was fine. But if we allow a child encourage a child to make an irrevocable decision like changing genders before they're 18, we are doing something tragic to that child.
I agree with you as far as the age limitation, and at the same time, I'm thinking that in terms of allowing people to feel comfortable in their own skin, for a long time, I was very much opposed to this whole aspect of plastic surgery, just in general. And that's not, we're not talking about gender reassignment either. We're talking just about
plastic surgery.
Plastic surgery.
You are who you are, right?
And it's like, yeah, and you are who you are. But at the same time, if you don't feel comfortable to the point where you have difficulty functioning, some would say, well, then maybe you need to seek therapy. Maybe you do. I don't know. But if following that procedure and you look in the mirror and you like who you see for the first time in your life, to me, that's a positive, so that you can then move on and hopefully fulfill the purpose for which you came into this
life for. For adults, that's absolutely right.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I would urge adults to do whatever makes them
feel more
comfortable.
Well, anybody under 18 is still growing. They're still changing.
They're still
as well.
Growing and changing. They're becoming who they are. I would certainly support the child. My parents really didn't notice much different about me, except that I was very much a tomboy mm-hmm. in the way I dressed and in the way I played. I could beat up when I was 8. I remember I could beat up every boy in my entire class.
They didn't go for much for that, did they?
No, it was not a good way to make friends. But that was fine. I mean, it just...
Yeah. I've known tomboys.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Some girls who, they were just rough and tumble, and that's just the way they were. But as they grew up, into teen years
hormones
and adulthood?
Hormones do a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I mean, they really help you become comfortable with the body that you happen to have, which you chose for a reason. The part of the problem is people don't understand that we are eternal minds. Your mind is eternal. It never began. It never will end. And because our minds are eternal, to be in a lifetime where you kind of wish you were the other gender, but you chose this don't realize, but mm-hmm. will in the future, we'll all come to understand this is true. To have that kind of little inconvenience is not that big a thing. You're going to have a million lives.
Yeah.
Not a million. That's probably high, but very, very many lives to be whichever gender you prefer. It's just not... Because we are so misled by mainstream science and by Christianity, most people don't understand that we live forever, we make terrible mistakes about the life choices we make since we think this is our one and only life.
Mm.
It's not.
Yeah.
It is not at all.
I remember following my first and only divorce that people used to look at me and say, wow, you look so different. It's like... You know, you've taken on a whole new life. And I thought, oh, kind of neat. Reincarnation in one lifetime. I'll take it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure people go through that all the time when they have rather traumatic or rather eventful types of things happen.
Sure.
It changes their aura, their demeanor, their energy, and so forth. I didn't really notice, other than coming out of depression, because of having to go through the process in and of itself, I was always and always have been, and I think always will be, a very optimistic and happy person, always trying to find solutions. You know, I was watching, the movie where, oh, it was a Martian. That was the movie Martian. And the astronaut was up there on Mars, and basically he was left behind because something had gone wrong. And he had a choice to make. So and I kind of put it this way. He either choose you're going to live or you're going to die. Dying, that's easy. Just lay there and wait.
I haven't seen the movie. Is there never going to come get him again? Is that
well,
the premise?
I'm not going to. No spoiler alerts here.
Okay.
But what I will tell you is that he made choices as to how he was going to be able to sustain his life.
Yeah.
And it was like, and he solved that problem, and then he had another one, and then he solved that one, and he just kept, that was the whole process that he was going through while he was sitting there waiting for someone to come or not to come. But that's really kind of where I'm coming from is that I've always been that type of person that, you know, you have one problem, you solve it, and then
you're
there's gonna another
one. You're
going
to make the best of whatever happens.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And so as far as up through the age of 18, that's really what you need to do, and hopefully there are people around you to support you in making the best of it. And then if you want to make a change, whatever it is, at least wait until you are, I guess maybe the word is legally emancipated.
Mm, yes.
to where you can make those changes.
Yes.
But we've kind of gone drifted off here a little bit because I was asking you about how you became interested in this whole aspect of death and dying.
I love it how you stay on track.
Well, I'm trying.
That's a good mind that can do that.
I'm thankful I do not run Amtrak. We'd be in a world of hurt right now. So let's continue that narrative, if you will.
When I was 8 years old, a good little Christian child, I woke up in the middle of the night one night. Actually, it was April 9th, 1955, and I realized that there's no God, and I was terrified. In the middle of my room, there was a flash of white light, and a voice said, "You wouldn't know what it is to have me unless you knew what it is to be without me. I will never leave you again." Of course, when you're eight, everything surprises you, so nothing does. All I thought at the time was, isn't it handy if you forget there's a God, they remind you, and I went back to sleep. But I never asked a question, never got an answer. And yet these experiences, and they're not nearly as common as near-death experiences, but they do happen to people when they're in great spiritual distress. I have met other people who have had very similar experiences, and there are two in the Bible. I mean, Moses with his burning bush, Saul, the great persecutor of Christians, on the road to Damascus, and he then became the Apostle Paul. So it happens, but it's rare.
Yeah.
However, I wanted to know where that light came from. I even majored in Christianity in college without any thought of what I would do with it, except I thought, once you're in college, they must tell you what happens if you forget there's a God. Never asked a question, never got an answer. And eventually I decided that light has to have come from where the dead are now. So I decided I would figure out where the dead are. And I started that right out of college, and I've worked on it ever since. Hmm. And it is possible to know. And the reason it's possible to know is that every communication before 1950, those are the ones I studied, we have a lot of them.
Yeah.
And they're so consistent in every way. Big picture, it's sort of, I say in The Fun of Dying, it's like reading hundreds of communications from people who have been to Fiji over the last 100-odd years.
Hmm.
Very different experiences, but it's the same place.
Yeah.
And that's how I knew all of this was real. But it was so peculiar. The physics was peculiar. There's so many things we still didn't understand. It really was not until the start of this century when we started to get good quantum physics for dummies books. We had a clearer understanding of consciousness and how it operates, that the researchers, and there are quite a few researchers who've done this and are meeting now and coming together. And we finish each other's sentences because we've all come to the same conclusions. But it's possible to figure it out, and that's why in 2010 I wrote The Fun of Dying. Actually, the reason I wrote The Fun of Dying when I did is very simple. I went through a crisis of faith. I had been very Christian, and when I realized in my early 50s that there's no evidence whatsoever that anything that I learned as a Christian is true. In fact, there's evidence it's not true. It's pretty obviously not true, and I was so troubled by that that it was a while before I picked up my Bible and looked at it again and realized that we have a witness who 2,000 years ago told us things about God, reality, death, the afterlife, and the meaning and purpose of our lives that we could not have confirmed by any other means until the 20th century. So that's why I wrote The Fun of Dying. I figured I have a witness now from way back then, and I have all these witnesses, you know, in the 20th century. There's no earthly way this isn't true.
And the interesting thing about it is that for me, when I hear about someone who has transitioned, I like to use that word myself because the other words are so negatively energetically charged, people get very fearful. I ask myself that same kind of question is, what are they doing?
What are they experiencing? Oh, there's so much fun there. You have no idea.
Yeah.
The great thing about the afterlife is that there's a period, and it's as long as you want it to be, right after you transition, which is like R&R. It's play. Anything you liked doing here, you can do there. I have a friend who's a very advanced being, and he learned to snowboard when he was here, and now he snowboards all the time in the afterlife levels. Way better snowboarding than here, he says, because you can fall down and you don't get hurt. And any kind of craft, music, singing, just everything you want to do. There are all kinds of vehicles. If you wanted a Maserati here and you never could have it, you can have it there. Just anything you want. Airplanes, you want to fly around in your own airplane, you can do it there. Boats?
Motorcycles, here I come.
Motorcycles, absolutely. Absolutely right.
I have to say that I was greatly intrigued by the movie Defending Your Life with Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep. It came out many years ago. And I used to think that wouldn't that be a great experience? Now, Albert, he was his character, you know, he was fearful of the whole experience and going to review his life, you know, thinking that he was going to be judged. Well, not in the way he was thinking that he was going to be judged. Whereas Meryl, she was having the time of her life, and she was eating anything and everything that she wanted to, and her reviews were fantastic. I mean, it was just a great experience for her. And I find that, boy, wouldn't that be nice to, you know, and I've heard it said that, not quite in those descriptive words, but that, yes, there is a review. But I remember I went through, when I was going through my, and I've referred to this sort of as my own PhD program that extended, went on for 15 years when I worked for the Christian radio station. I was asking all kinds of questions that only the heretics would ask, because I was questioning the founding fathers.
Yes.
Because I wasn't buying the answers to the questions, because they didn't make any logical sense. And
yes.
I knew, and you talk about how you have this one individual 2,000 years ago who now with 21st century science validates.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm sitting here going, I'm kind of thinking the same thing, that the answers to these questions that I'm asking, they don't make any logical sense. And even in the Bible, there is a passage along that, and forgive me for taking this out of context, but I don't think I'm taking it too far out, that says, let us sit and reason together. The only way you can reason is if you use your brain.
All right.
Okay?
That's right.
And so that takes logic, and you have to have problem-solving skills, and you have to have all of the other aspects in that regard. I mean, that's why I love talking. Some of my favorite conversations have been with philosophers. There's a philosophy instructor, a professor of philosophy over at City College here in Santa Barbara, and he's been on my program a couple of times. Rabbis, Jewish rabbis. I love talking with them because, number one, the level of education that they have to reach that level. And then some of the explanations to some of the questions that I was asking, it made sense. It made logical sense. So I want to kind of continue moving forward with all of this. How does the knowledge of all of this, as far as the next life or what, however we want to phrase this, how does that help us here now in terms of making a better life for ourselves and our offspring, if you will, and generations to come?
Oh, what a great question. And I have a great answer.
Mm-hmm.
The dead and the master all tell us that we are here to grow spiritually. That is the reason the universe exists. Fear is the worst negative energy. Fear of death is so unnecessary, and once you free yourself from it, it seems to be the base fear, and you lose so many other fears as well. So the first and most important reason to me to make a study of this and really convince yourself that your mind is eternal is that it frees you from fear, and it makes it much easier to grow spiritually. But here's something that I'm in the process of writing a book about now. The Fun of Growing Forever will be about how to use the teachings of Jesus, which turn out to be a system.
Mm-hmm.
He gave us a system for spiritual growth, which is easy to follow. It's fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun. It doesn't require any special practices like chanting or meditating or any of the stuff I don't have the patience to do. And it's miraculous.
Mm-hmm.
Christians have no idea what they have buried in their Bible. But how does that help the world? Simple. Our minds are all part of eternal mind, which is the only thing that exists.
Mm-hmm.
We are all essentially one being, all 7-odd billion of us. And when enough people have raised their spiritual vibration sufficiently, and I think it's only like 10 or 20%, no more than that, then everything will change, because that raises the vibrations of even people like ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
The most evil, depraved people you can imagine can't be evil or depraved anymore when enough of us have raised our consciousness high enough. There's a massive effort being undergone now. It's coming from the highest levels of what we think of as the place where the dead are. They're trying to raise the consciousness of the planet so we don't destroy the planet, and as a very useful school.
Yeah.
The teachings of Jesus are probably the easiest way. And forget Christianity. That's not, this is not about Christianity.
That's the interesting thing, is that there is a separation.
There's a, because the Christians don't follow Jesus. They
don't. If he were here today, my opinion is, if he were here today, they wouldn't recognize him.
No. Well, and he certainly wouldn't recognize them as following him, because they don't follow. Nobody opens. They don't open and read their Gospels apart from the rest of the book.
And then there's another aspect, too, that I find really ironic. I have to look at it from a humorous perspective because it's sad. And I can't think of any other word to use other than bigotry towards the religions of the Middle East, and there are a lot of them. It's not just Muslim and Jewish, Judaism. But what the Christians do not seem to grasp yet is that Christianity is a Middle Eastern religion.
It's actually a first century Jewish sect.
Exactly.
And it's never gone beyond that, because it's never been allowed to go beyond that.
Yeah. And you and I was born and raised Catholic. You and I actually should be practicing the AD version of Judaism. We should be Jews, not Christians, because Jesus was a Jew. And if you're following Jesus, he was a Jew.
He was never a Christian.
Am I right?
Right. Of course you're
right. Thank you.
You're very smart, Richard.
Well, I try not to load it over. But the other thing, too, is that... And I ask these same kinds of questions that you talk about, especially in terms of God and the devil. Those were some big issues, as well as if hell really existed. And I actually I consciously recall it taking me 5 years to work through the whole aspect that kept being thrown up in my face. What if the Christians are right?
They're not right.
Well, but the point was...
We can prove now that they're not right.
But the point for me was... I needed to come to a place where I could say, so what if they are right? What am I supposed to do with that? And again, everything that I was learning from Jewish rabbis, as well as others of other religions, swamis and so forth, was telling me, and this was the biggest thing for me of all, as far as the devil, the evil one, was concerned. And I actually did a search in my concordance in the Old Testament. And what I found was that there was no reference to a personal individual who was the evil one.
And that person or being does not exist.
Right. And
we can
prove
that
in the Jewish tradition and interpretation of the Torah, it refers not to an individual, but the lowest base nature of man. That's as low as man can get.
Right. Yes.
So it's a behavior, if you will. It's a mindset, just as being of the higher consciousness, the Christ consciousness, if you will, that you hear about not just in Christianity, although not in that phrase, but you hear it in Hinduism, and you hear it in many other religions and other other types of teachings. And it, to me, that's what really fascinated me, was the conversations. I remember reading the Conversations of the Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East, one long name, by the author by the name of Spalding. And you were talking about Jesus, and I remember the passage that I had highlighted where they had met Jesus and Pilate in this cave. Now, this was, whether it was an apparition or what have you, but the thing that struck me was what Jesus had to say about how he was deified and how saddened about he was by that, because he couldn't commune with the very beings that he wanted to, because they thought too highly of him. And he was, you know, and then there was a certain element of, I guess, loneliness in that.
He's a big shot, let me tell you, in the afterlife levels. Yeah. He is revered. They are loved.
But he's reachable.
Followed. Yeah, he's the teacher. They call him the master. They really don't call him ever by his name. Mm-hmm. And No church ever holds him in the kind of esteem that the dead hold him, which is kind of tragic and ironic. Look, I love Christianity.
Yeah.
I was a Protestant. Then I was a very zealous Catholic after my marriage. Mm-hmm. Nobody has ever loved Christianity more than I have. And it breaks my heart to have to say this. But Christianity is actually one of our biggest barriers to spiritual growth because it instills fear in its followers.
Yeah.
Fear is the lowest vibratory rate. You can't grow spiritually when you're afraid. And even worse than instilling fear, the fear it instills is the fear of God. God is nothing but perfect love. I used to, my husband still is Catholic, and I went to church with him for years after I stopped otherwise practicing just because I love him.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I had to stop because every time I entered that church, the old fear would rise.
Yeah.
And you cannot love God when you fear God. It's not possible.
Again, another one of those answers to questions that didn't make any logical sense.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I mean, I went round in circles because I would hear these sermons on the radio in particular about how we were nothing but lowly worms. You know,
oh,
we were
goodness.
Just vile creatures and, you know, on and on and on and on. And
which is not in the Bible.
Yeah.
The Bible says we are created a little lower than the angels and crowned with glory and honor.
Yeah.
That's what's true.
Yeah. And then I hear the disparaging comments about the heart of man. And yet we're finding from a scientific perspective that that is the seat of, and I love this, the seat of emotion, which to me breaks down into energy which generates motion in the physical world. And it's the emotion is coming from that higher place too. In other words, you have the thought in the etheric plane, if you want, from the higher consciousness, from your higher self, and it travels down into the heart, and then you generate the energy and you begin to move forward in your life, doing things. I don't know if that diagram is scientifically based.
Well, the problem is that scientists are based in materialism.
Mm.
The gatekeepers, the peer-reviewed journals, the university departments will not allow anything to be studied or written about that is not based in the notion of materialism, which is ironic because even the scientists at this point know that there is no such thing as matter. Max Planck said that 100 years ago. There is no matter as such. And yet they're still stuck in materialism. Let's not be crazy.
Well, I'll take that one step further. And they're also talking about this other concept called dark matter.
Yes.
Which they can't, other than through mathematical equations, prove that it exists. But they say that it's there. And to me, that's also just as contradictory to, you know, the aspects of science needing to deal in the material.
That less than 5% of what scientists know exists is what we think of as the matter that we can see and feel in this universe. I mean, 95% plus, they'd have no idea what it is. It's not material because it doesn't interact with photons of light. You'd think they'd be more curious about whether maybe it might have a purpose. And indeed, it does. I'm pretty sure that dark energy is, in fact, the source energy. And I have other reasons for saying that.
I wouldn't be surprised. I really wouldn't. Roberta Grimes is my guest. We're talking about a lot of stuff here, but she's...
We're having fun.
And we are indeed. She's the author of Liberating Jesus, The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch. We'll talk more about all of these different aspects, as well as your journeys and where you're going to and coming from and going to, as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for staying with us. Myself and Roberta Grimes, and we're talking about a wide variety of things surrounding the afterlife as we know it. Dark matter and physics and this is one of the things that I loved about the job at the radio station was the fact that back in Phoenix was that in addition to getting in a little broadcasting on the side, I was learning about this is the way I phrase it, about comparative religions, or if you will, Christian sects, which some people would take umbrage with, I think, being referred to as a sect, but it is. That's
mm-hmm.
all the
That's
denominations
right.
are sects. Philosophy, psychology, political science. You know, I mean, we're saying that in our present day political cycle that we're in here in 2016, where religion has been brought up, Christianity has been brought up, and all of these different arguments. And it's like, wait a minute, you're upset about this other group of religions, this other religion that has these extremists that want to incorporate the laws as they see them from their religion into day-to-day life. And you say that's wrong, and yet you want to do the same thing here in this quote-unquote Judeo-Christian country. And again, it goes right back to these institutions, and I'm asking these questions because the answers that I've been given don't make any sense.
No, they don't make any sense. And what's tragic is, and one of the ways we can tell that Christianity is on the wrong track, not on the track that Jesus intended, is that by count, there are now more than 40,000 different versions of Christianity, which is shocking. Because not only do Christians cut themselves off from other people, which is the opposite of what the Lord taught, but they cut themselves off from one another. You know, if you're not in my particular church, maybe you won't rapture, which it will never happen. It's just frustrating to see it so sadly off track.
And what I have experienced is the fact that of those, what did you say, 40,000? Even within each one of those church buildings, shall we say, of let's just say 1,000 people.
Right.
What the minister, the pastor, the hierarchy does not seem to grasp is that of the thousands of the 1,000 people that are your congregation, there were 1,000 different versions of Christianity right there in the pews, because I have found that no two people, even of the same denomination, believe exactly the same things.
Well, that's true. And it shouldn't be about beliefs. It should be about knowledge and understanding, because there is one truth. I do my own podcasting, and in fact, I'm about to get a radio show. It's called Seek Reality, because that's what we should be doing. If we seek reality, we'll find it. Jesus says that, actually. However, people instead are sort of mired in beliefs that are almost 2,000 years old. They were codified in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. That's Christianity. That's where it's stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember going around in circles with different heads of different denominations, again, at this station, you know, and saying, well, wait a minute. All right. I hear what you're saying and what you've just stated. And I'm sitting here going, well, I have two questions. First of all, who set them up as the arbiters of the faith? Who put them in charge?
Well, they said they were inspired by Jesus, or inspired by God, rather. Inspired by God. Why would you believe me? Why are we believing them, especially since the religion that they've passed down, which contains this precious nugget of truth in those four canonical gospels, the rest of it, Jesus did not want to have put with his gospels. He tells us right in the gospels that we should replace the entire Old Testament with God's law of love. He says it in the gospels. Instead, what they did was package his gospels with those books he tried to get rid of.
Well, you know, it's real interesting because you had mentioned two individuals from the Bible, Moses and, of course, Paul. And after having read the Bible a couple of times, both Old and New Testament, I came to the conclusion that beyond the book of Acts, if the people had gotten it, we wouldn't need the other letters.
No, you wouldn't. I mean, I love Paul. He gave us a great gift. He packaged the teachings so that we can have them today and use them to save the world and ourselves, of course, from spiritual decay and destruction. And it's about spiritual growth. It's not about anything else. But it's as if we've spent 2,000 years playing with the wrapping of Paul's gift. It's time for us to open the wrapping and see the gift inside, which is those four precious gospels. The teachings of Jesus on love and forgiveness and how we are to be living our lives are the most precious gift God ever has given to us. And yet Christians ignore those teachings almost altogether. They think it's they're suggestions. Jesus does not ever say in the gospels, these are just suggestions. Yeah. He says, you will be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect.
Well, I got to stop you right there.
Yes, sir.
this is not to contradict you, but this is to elucidate on what you just quoted. The passage that you just quoted, be perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. I remember hearing that And it was in the context of dialogue having to do with living an upright life, i.e. good versus evil, right versus wrong, and so forth. But as I began to do my own Bible study, this was back in the 80s and 90s, I began to realize that that is not the definition of the word perfect in that passage. The definition of perfect in that passage is defined by my concordance, my Strong's concordance, and I would sit with someone and say, okay, we need to accept without reservation, you know, to set aside any argument that the Bible and the concordance are valid sources, okay? And otherwise, we can't continue the conversation. Well, that definition has to do with being complete. Complete. Totally different from being right or wrong, good or bad.
Yeah, I think that the thing that Christians miss is that the Gospels are about spiritual growth and the easiest and most effective way to grow spiritually, which is why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
And what the problem Christians have is that they're obsessed with rules. Rules do not change you at all. They might change your behavior, but they don't change your heart. The thing about the teachings of Jesus, if you follow them carefully, is that they change you internally and pretty quickly. They do change your heart. They transform you, and therefore they will give us the power to transform the world. But Christians won't stop and listen to that. I'm so surprised that Jesus means so little to them.
And I remember my conversation with a rabbi once in that regard as well. I know that there are 613 Jewish laws in the book of Leviticus. 613.
Wow. I never counted them.
And of course, in the New Testament, what about the laws? Well, the law is summed up in one. Actually, in a manner of speaking, it's two. You love God, you know, and so forth.
The law of love. That was Jesus' revelation
right.
when he came to earth.
I didn't come to abolish. I came to fulfill it.
Exactly.
And now it's do unto others as you would have them do unto you is kind of the way it's phrased. I love rephrasing it by saying, do unto others as if you were the others.
Which is good.
Yeah.
But what Jesus says is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the second rule is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And most Christians can quote that. What they don't realize is that right after that comes, in that consists all the law and the prophets.
Yeah.
He has fulfilled the Old Testament and replaced the law and the prophets, which is what they call the Old Testament, with the law of love.
Yeah.
It's black and white.
It was like there was this contract written at the beginning of time from before the creation. Okay, here are all the rules. But there's going to come a point when someone's going to come along and they're going to sign off on the contract and it's going to be done. It's kind of like, you know, you buy a car and you've got 60 months to pay and you make the 60th payment. It's done. Now there's a whole new set of rules, if you will, but not really. There's only one.
There's only one. We were at that point 2,000 years ago ready because we understood there was one God. We were ready to meet that God, Spirit. You know, and nothing but love is what God actually is. God is not like the Christian God at all, the God that the afterlife researchers have mm-hmm. discovered. And all those rules that Christians don't follow, like the rules in Leviticus, whenever you see a clean-shaven Christian, you know he does not take the Old Testament seriously unless it suits him.
Yeah.
Because you're supposed to follow all those rules or, frankly, none of them.
And you can't take one.
That's right.
Without taking the other 612.
Right, right.
Well, we were talking specifically about the passage regarding men laying with men or women laying with women, right? And how that's been interpreted. And according to this rabbi that I was talking with, he says, the context has been missed, and the reason why that was laid down, no pun intended, it was so that the procreative process of mankind would not stop.
Right.
We're now in the 21st century. It doesn't matter anymore. We can continue the procreative process.
It is the most unloving thing I can imagine for people to judge other people by whom they love.
Yeah.
And yet Christians feel free to do that, and they do it in the name of Jesus and in the name of God, which is a shame.
And judge not lest ye be judged. That's the New Testament.
That ye be not judged. That's Jesus says that.
Yeah.
Forgive and you'll be forgiven. All of those things. We are meant to love. If we're acting out of love, it doesn't matter what we do. No rule applies. Just love. If we are acting without love, which is what Christians are doing when they condemn homosexuals or people who just are different from them, mm-hmm. they're not acting out of love. Yeah. They're acting out of fear. And that is the worst thing we can do if we're trying to follow the Lord.
Now, just so people understand, I am not anti-Christian. I was born and raised Catholic.
We both love Christianity. Yeah.
And I was when I was married to my first wife, I was I had the great opportunity of experiencing the Eastern Rite or the Byzantine Rite. Very ritualistic, very much in tradition. They would do, in this case, they would do the liturgy. It was the same liturgy every week, and they would do it in both English and, from this particular church, in Slavonic.
Wow.
And I was a part of that for like 10, 12 years. And I grew to really enjoy it, whether I understood it or not. It was being a part of a community, and they were all sharing in this same wonderful ritual. And the holidays
yes.
of Easter and Christmas.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember some of the other holidays. But needless to say, so I still have a great love. I mean, I love the incense and the candles and the music.
I used to love going to Mass with my husband. That was a glorious experience for me. And I ended up not being able to do it anymore because above the altar in that Catholic church was a life-size, full-color plaster Jesus nailed to a cross, bleeding. And every time I looked at that, the old fear of God would come back. I couldn't enter the church eventually. It makes me very sad because I loved going.
I was always frustrated by that image because I thought, why are they focusing so much upon the death?
That's because right. To make you feel guilty, Richard. That's why. Look what you made him do.
Rise again. He rose.
Of course
why can't we have something symbolizing
of course he did.
The rising?
And the empty cross is no better. It's still a first century electric chair. It's an execution device. Yeah. Why is that a religious symbol?
I remember asking the Monsignor of the Byzantine Church when we were, this was back in the 80s, and I said, according to the historical record, when someone was crucified, the final indignation was that they were stripped naked. And Jesus went through that too. I said, so why don't the crucifixes show that?
Because then they would be X-rated now.
Well,
they're only...
and to that, I was flabbergasted, but I was also rather gratefully astonished at his answer, that he was actually willing to answer the question. Because we don't want to upset the sensibilities of the congregation. And I thought, but isn't it also quoted, Jesus quoted, you shall know the truth and the truth will set you free? I mean, I'm just, all of these things start flooding in and I just start questioning. And then, I'm told to do this or that or the other to squash the questioning. Just go along. And I can't do that. I'm sorry. I can't do that when it comes to politics. I can't do it when it comes to education in this country in particular. I can't do it when it comes to economics. Who said that this is the only economic system that there should ever be? You know, the powers that be say that this is the only economic system. We've never tried other things beyond what we've already tried. We're willing to think outside the box when it comes to electronics and space and science and physics and quantum physics. We're thinking all kinds of outside the box. But boy, when it comes to those kinds of things, religion and economics and politics, it's got to stay.
And I love that you quoted that little passage from John, which is so important. Jesus did say it. What he said was, though, and people don't pay attention to this, mm-hmm. if you hold to my teachings, you are really my disciples. Mm. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Mm. That is 100% absolute truth. We can prove that mm-hmm. now. But most Christians do not follow the teachings. They're not really his disciples. It's time for Christianity to turn to Jesus, not to the religion, nothing else but Jesus. Opening to the Gospels, open your Bible to the Gospels, read his teachings on love and forgiveness and why we're here.
You have done, I'm sure, some very extensive biblical research to find those passages, both in the Old and New Testaments.
Right.
I'm not sure if the word support is correct, but I'll use it. Many of the positions you take in regards to the afterlife, as we're using that term here, mm-hmm. to those who die, because it was also, it's also quoted from the New Testament that it is appointed for every man once to die and then the judgment.
But Jesus, that's right. Jesus didn't say that.
No, he didn't. But then go back to the Gospels. Jesus raises Lazarus from, quote unquote, the dead. Now, was he dead or wasn't he dead? And is it appointed every man once to die and then the judgment, or twice?
Or many times. Right.
And
in
then,
fact, Jesus did teach reincarnation, and the Council of Nicaea in 325 removed every reference it could find, and the reason it gave for editing the Gospels, if you can imagine such a thing, and taking things out and putting things in, the reason it gave for removing reincarnation was it thought that people wouldn't try hard. If they think they have only one chance, they'll try harder. If you can imagine this, the sacrilege, the stupidity of that tells you everything you need to know. You do not want to I majored in early Christian history in college, so I got to learn a lot about the councils. It's like watching sausage being made. If you want to think that's really the inspired word of God, do not learn anything about those councils.
Yeah, and it's really kind of sad, too, because, you know, I remember when we were celebrating, I think it was back in the 90s, the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus sailing to the New World. Mm-hmm. Not to America, but to the New World.
Right.
And I remember learning about him in history class in high school, grade school and high school. And the stories that I heard, three different versions of the history of Christopher Columbus during that 500th anniversary. And I'm going, wait a minute. How is it we have three?
I'm sure there are more than three.
And then I have to say, too, that we have a document that we're supposed to live by in this country called the Constitution of the United States, written about 240, 50 years, whatever the number is, over 200 years ago. And there's one particular amendment, the Second Amendment, having to do with gun rights. And I did a little research on that, and I'm not going into detail, but my point is, that they fought about it in the 1700s, 1800s, and 1900s, and they're still fighting about it today. It was written in very clear, understandable English, right? And yet there is still no unification of thought on that amendment. And yet we're supposed to accept a document that's over 2,000 years old, that's been manipulated and modified and abridged and on by men.
Right.
And we're supposed to accept that that is perfect and not flawed. And it wasn't even written in English.
No. I have read the Bible from cover to cover, I think, 6 to 8 times. I started in my teens. I read it every night until I was in my 50s, right through. And then I would go back to Matthew, read just the New Testament, and then the whole Bible again. I know it pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can sit down and start with Genesis and get to Revelation and possibly believe that whole book is the inspired word of a rational, loving, sane God. You can't. Even an internally consistent God, it's full of contradictions.
Yeah.
And what mostly happens is the Old and the New Testaments contradict the precious, perfect teachings of Jesus. Mm. How can we call ourselves, if we're Christians, and I still think of myself as Christian, how can we call ourselves Christians if we're not following Christ, for heaven's sake?
Well, now I have to ask the question, because this will clarify for everybody where you're coming from.
I'm not sure I know where I'm coming from.
So, which version were you reading?
Well,
and does it really matter?
I think we have to read the modern translation, the New American Study Bible. There are several. I'm trying to think of which one I now have. I've had several. I think people need to buy any of the new modern English translations with red letters.
Yeah.
That's all. If the words of Jesus are in red letters, and if it's a modern Bible, it's fine.
Yeah.
In writing my books, I've had to use a version which might not be my first choice, but it's a very good one. And it's NASB, and I can't remember now what that stands for. But they have more liberal rights to quote the
New
Bible.
American Standard. New American Standard.
New American Standard, yeah.
I have maybe 8 or 10 different versions, including Yahweh, a Bible that every time God is mentioned, it's Yahweh or Yahshua in the New Testament.
Yes.
Which, again, that's a whole nother direction that we could go. I have a King James. I have New American Standard. I have I even have a version of the New Testament that was written, and actually it's considered to have been channeled, okay, as far as the corrections, through a gentleman back in the 1930s. His name was Johannes Graeber, and I was introduced to him through one of his books, a real thick book called Communication with the Spirit World of God. Now, what was interesting about this particular book was the fact that Johannes Graeber was a Catholic priest, very devout, and somehow he connected with this individual who was channeling this entity that was really taking to task and really beating up on the Catholic Church back in the 30s.
Yes.
So that was a little difficult for him to take at first, but he, for whatever reason, he continued. It wasn't something like, no, this is heresy. I will not have anything to do with this. There are people like Edgar Cayce. He was a Christian, and yet he continued. I've read all of his books. There are these individuals that have been that have come down through the pages of history who have had their beliefs, but they've also had these other experiences.
Yes. Oh, that's. I think this is a very good point. I mean, Saint Francis of Assisi is one who, in everything he did, he clearly was being directly contacted by, inspired by Jesus. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. There are many people I think who have been.
You know, and what's interesting is back in his day, he probably would have been thought of as a heretic. In today's, in our modern day, you're a nut job. Yeah, sure. You talk to Jesus. Sure, you do. Okay.
But the things he says are beautiful, profound, and true. He cuts through. I mean, the ritual is useless, and the fear, instilling fear in parishioners is the greatest.
I never understood that myself.
Well, it's the greatest crime that Christianity commits, because fear is the opposite of love. Well, the reason it's done is simple. First, we instill the fear, and then we give you an antidote for the fear that you can have if you come to church. And that seems to be, this is true of all religions, I think. They instill a great fear, usually of God, and then they tell you that as long as you're in their fold, you're safe from God.
I came up with one word to describe the concept of belief in God and following God and the teachings of Jesus according to the modern Christian theology. And that one word is extortion.
Oh,
unless
Lord.
You do it this way, you're going to hell.
Yes. Oh, yes. But I would never have said that. Let it be known, Richard said that. I didn't say it. No, but you're right, of course. How do we keep people in the pews? We tell them, if you don't keep coming, you're going to go to hell. And we teach the children this.
Yeah.
Now, we have learned there is no fiery hell, and the only there is, however, the outer darkness where there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth, which is what Jesus tells us. Mm-hmm. He was right about that, too.
Yeah.
But we put ourselves there. We put ourselves there by not growing spiritually enough to be of a high enough vibration to be in the better parts of where we go after death. It's that simple. This is all physics. It really, there's no judgment by any religious figure, ever. I've never seen it, nor has any other researcher.
So as we live our lives and we do what we can to raise our own consciousness.
Yes.
And hopefully the people around us, but our own, when we do transition, if we could show parallel lives where one lifetime you didn't do this, but at the same time the other lifetime you did, the entity is not going to go into the same realm in the next life? Is that what I'm
hearing?
Think
of it. Everybody's right exactly where we are. Your loved ones are in the room with you now. Everything is in the same place. Think of it as if your mind is a TV set. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's tuned to this level of reality, this material, which we think is the lowest, and to that particular body, in fact, on this level of reality. When you die, all that happens is that your mind tunes to a slightly higher channel. A TV set turns a slightly higher channel, not even very much higher, and it picks up a whole new solid reality right in the same place we are, just as your TV can do that.
Okay. But what I'm asking is in terms of that, when we transition into the out of the material world, Are we all transitioning into exactly the same place?
No.
Or there are different levels, if you will. I've heard of like seven different heavens. And...
Yes, but there actually are a lot of sublevels too. In fact, the dead don't even think in terms of levels. The more advanced you are spiritually, the more places you can access. You always can go lower in terms of spiritual vibration, and you just basically think to the lower level and you're there. You can't go higher than what your own spiritual development will allow. So you can't go to the fifth or sixth level if you're not very well spiritually developed. You're going to be on level three or lower. Mm-hmm. But level three is beautiful. It's just...
Sure.
We crave, once we get back home, we crave developing spiritually like every craving of your life together. And we, the people who are there and didn't make the most of their lifetimes for spiritual growth kick themselves because they came in with a plan to grow. Mm. And darn it, now they're going to come back and do it again.
Yeah. And I have two questions on that. Do they have to really? Or can they stay there and say, I'm just going to mire in level three?
They can stay for as long as they want to. There's no time there as we understand time. They can stay there forever. But it's craving. I mean, it's like every food, drink, sex, money, everything you've ever craved wrapped up together and multiplied by 1,000 is how much we crave spiritual growth when we're there. Mm. Not at first. When we first get back, we're just having fun. It's R&R time. But then we start to really hunger for spiritual growth. Mm-hmm. And that's when we get together with others and we work with a spirit guide. We start getting ready and we plan another lifetime. Mm. And this time we plan it with enough negativity in it of a specific set of kinds of negativity that we think is going to really help us grow spiritually.
Right.
And we come in and try. But because our culture, our religion, our science, nothing tells us we're here to grow spiritually. People don't even understand why they're here. So of course they're not trying. Then they get home and they go, darn it, I did it again. Now I have to come back another time. You can make it in one lifetime if you just work hard at growing.
And they get to the other side, oh, I should have had a V8.
Right.
Or
right.
Some spiritual
right.
equivalent thereof.
Yes.
Very interesting. It fascinates me because, again, as I said earlier, I'm always intrigued when someone famous or not so much passes on. You hear about them in the news, and not every single one of them triggers that question. What are they doing now? What are they experiencing? What's happening? You know, I would love to be the proverbial fly on the wall to just kind of observe and see what's happening and come back and report or at least know myself. And yet, even though we have people who have had these near-death experiences, it's not quite the same thing because they came back and yes, they'll tell us whatever it is that they tell us.
The evidence is, and when I say the evidence, the dead tell us that people who have near-death experiences or who travel astrally do not go to the same places where the dead go. They travel in the astral levels and in mimics of where the dead go. This is nothing I made up. This is just what the dead tell us.
Right.
And I suspect it may be right because when people actually die, it's a remarkably consistent experience.
Mm-hmm.
The tunnel with the light, I never heard of that until I started reading near-death experiences. Mm. It doesn't happen in an ordinary death, in a regular planned death.
Right.
I think it's a rescue device because you're out of your body. You're not supposed to be out of your body. You're going to come higher now, but you're going to end up in what amounts to the outer darkness and go through negativity. And to prevent that, they hoover you right through the bad areas, right into the light of the higher levels. I think that's all it is.
So what about that aspect? I mean, you know, I was asking this earlier in the program about, you know, we see television programs, Ghost Whisperer in particular, where she's always helping these people to try to go to the light, you know, and yet they're stuck here and so forth. I've got an author I'm going to have on who he has experiences of these entities in the other world who are finding ways of communicating with him and sharing information with him and so on and so forth. And it's like, really? That's what they do? Or is there, again, and I'm asking in reference to that tunnel of light, is there a transition, not just from the material into the spiritual, but even a transition from the immediate post-material to the next level or something or other.
Here's what seems to be true. We don't automatically know where to go. It's when you are out of your body, it's just like you're a newborn baby. You need help. So we have deathbed visitors who are people we love and trust, or pets, whatever, will come and escort us through the it looks like a gray fog usually to get to the level three where nearly everybody enters. It's possible for someone who's out of his body or her body freshly to be distracted at the wrong time, because your vibration is high enough that you can see these people in your room, even though maybe nobody else can. But if you're distracted because your people are grieving around your bed, that you want to say, I'm fine, look at me, here I am. If you lower your vibratory rate at the wrong time, you will no longer see your deathbed visitors, and you can become stuck, out of time, without any idea of what's going on. People usually don't even realize they're dead, is what seems to be the case. And they just go back to their routine, but they think they are in their house. Even if it's 200 years later, they're still going through the wall because there was a door there when they were alive, and they have to be rescued. There are many people who have to be rescued for various reasons, and that rescuing goes on. That's one of the things we often...
So that is real, yeah.
But it's one of the things we often do when we first get there, because our vibratory rate is still increasing, and they're more likely to see us than they are to see higher-level beings.
It reminds me of that movie Sixth Sense.
Yes, that's a very good example.
And you're watching it thinking... Okay, I'm starting to get the indication that someone is dead here, but I don't know which one.
Yes, I love that.
Is it the boy or is it the man?
Yes.
I mean, yes. But again, those are the kinds of movies that you'll see. And of course, our entertainment industry, it seems like every so often they do try to enlighten us.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, other movies come out where they're trying to scare the bejesus out of us.
That's really too common, yes.
And it's I remember we went to see, and I did this as a kindness to my wife, the very first movie that came out. I think it was called Poltergeist or something like that. And they've made several after that. And supposedly it was real filmed stuff, but turns out it was all staged.
Yes.
And I sat through it, and I'm going, yeah, okay, fine, you know. And I just thought, why does anybody want to sit in a room and be scared? I don't understand.
Well, and it's bad, too, because you lower your personal vibratory rate. Yeah. I mean, that's not what we're here for. We're here to raise it. So anything that scares you is something you should not be
doing.
That's
why I don't like to listen to the news that
that's
much.
That's right. I haven't watched the news in years or listened to it on TV, on the radio. You're
so
right.
Who's the president of... Eisenhower? Who knows? Okay.
Doesn't matter, because it's all so corrupt at this point. It doesn't, you know, whether it's a D or an R, it really doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah, it really doesn't. And the way things are going in this particular cycle, it's like, you know, there's the fear on one side that their particular party will fall apart if this one guy is nominated.
No, but what they're really worried about is they're all at the trough feeding, this guy might take the trough away, and they don't want that.
Yeah, and it's like you're more worried about your party and your personal survival than you are about the country and its people.
Oh, you're so right.
There's something really wrong
with
that.
But it's going on both sides.
Oh, no, I'm not being accusatory for political reasons. You're absolutely right. Both sides.
And they collaborate in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they're putting on a kabuki dance for us. They think we're rubes, and we're not rubes.
Greatest example or explanation of American politics was explained to me this way. It's all theater.
It is.
It's all just theater.
Right. They lie and they lie and they lie. And I think what they're seeing is that people no longer believe anything they say.
Yeah.
Which is sad, because once you lose the faith of the people you govern, it won't be long before the government is overthrown in some way.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, not the overthrow part, but in terms of the lying. I was going to interview a gentleman who wrote a book called AD. And it stood for After Disclosure, but it had to do with aliens, and that the government was going to come out and they were going to reveal that, yes, it is true that we are not alone in the universe. There are aliens,
mm-hmm.
And I had already formulated my very first question to him. If the government's been lying for the last 50 years,
about that,
why would the country and its people believe them when they're saying we're telling the truth?
No. You're right. You're right.
It's about anything.
That's what's tragic about this whole thing. Neither party ever tells the truth anymore.
And it's sad. And then, of course, you know, even our other institutions, whether it be education or religious or what have you, they do the same things. And they repeat it and repeat it thinking, oh, they won't remember. And 9 times out of 10, we don't. And it gets repeated.
Too many people now are too wise to the fact that we're being taken for a ride.
Yeah. And they're tired of it.
Very tired of it. And that's otherwise Donald Trump would not have anybody voting for him.
Yeah.
To name someone. But they all have problems. I don't think there's one of them who doesn't.
I mean, there was a survey that I saw taken. They were doing it in studio with a group of people who weren't committed to neither of the front runners or neither of the parties. And, you know, and their biggest concern is that there is nobody there that they can vote for, that they can choose, and they're being asked to choose the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, I said, yeah, that may be true. But on the other hand, and this election is different from the others. How?
Well,
it's
only
not.
Because, no, it isn't. It's only because we're more aware now of just how bad it is.
Yeah. And I have to say that and this is just from my own personal observations, that the 2000 election was... actually, I should say the 1996 election was the last real election that we ever had. The 2000 election was decided by the Supreme Court because they told Florida, stop counting, you know. And I'm sitting here going, wait a minute. That's not the way it works. And, of course, I've heard the explanations from the past, from the Supreme Court justice who passed just recently. I've heard the explanations from other people I've shared this with, and that, you know, time was involved. You know, that we're running out of time. We it's like, wait, really? You will disenfranchise people because of time instead of getting it right. And so things have really changed in the 21st century. In a lot of ways.
It's really been a long time coming. I think it was after the Second World War that it started to go off the rails. Maybe in the 60s, 70s.
Well, of course, they say, you know, we lost our innocence in the 60s in particular.
Yes.
Through the three assassinations.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
You know, and we can never get that back.
Nope.
And I joke with people about this with Nixon, and that if he'd had me as his sound editor, he never would have been caught. Because I would have tightened up that 18 minutes for him.
Oh, my. it's too bad for him.
But, you know, it's just... and so I'm wondering, do you... the information that we have shared, especially regarding the afterlife and those who are sharing this information, is this from research you have done or direct communication?
It's from research. Anybody could have done what I'd done if you wanted to spend 40 years of your life with no other hobby, which is what I've done. Other than my horse, I also rode horseback. But it's all the information is available. The best communications were received before 1950, and they were reported on by serious researchers who thought they could interest science in this. And I've read them. Mm-hmm. And then figured out that they all talk about the same place. It's huge. It's tremendous, but it's the same place.
Yeah.
And when you put that together with aspects of scientific evidence, you see a more and more complete picture. There's a greater reality, which is many times the size of the universe. I'm thinking 15, 20 times maybe the size of the universe. And it teems with life. Yes, there are aliens, but most of them are in other dimensions. They aren't even necessarily in the material dimension.
And that's one final aspect I'd like to talk about is the universe. I mean, they say it goes on infinitely. It doesn't stop, you know, and I'm not sure how they conclude that because we haven't been sending probes out that far for that many years, as far as the universe's age. That we have reached the wall. And what relevance it is, I mean, I don't care much for the concept that somebody just determined that the Earth was flat. And then we did some things to disprove that the Earth is not flat and that the Earth is not the center of the universe. That I can kind of go along with, but it's like the universe is limitless. Well, I mean, is it? Have they made reference to that
most,
in any way?
They don't really care. The material universe is remarkably irrelevant when you study the greater reality, which is most of reality. In most of reality, physics is based in consciousness. It's based in consciousness here, too, as Max Planck discovered. But here there's an artificial math-based physics to keep us from messing with our school, because which we easily could do. In a consciousness-based physics, you just have to think something, and it exists. It's entirely different than here. There's no space there. There's no time there. So simultaneously, everything there is infinite in size and smaller than the dot of a pencil. Its size is just not a characteristic, which is even important. I mean, you know, when you have a dream, how big is your dream? That's kind of the truth. Now, my theory is, this is just a school. And my theory is they keep making the universe bigger and bigger so we won't find an edge to it. But that's it. This is just a school. There was I read years ago, and I wish I'd saved the article, someone had trained a telescope on a part of the universe where they'd never seen anything. It was like totally nothing was there. And he just forgot about it, went back a year later and looked, and it was full of galaxies. So they said, oh dear, the kids are seeing that there's a place where we have there's nothing. We have to fill it up. So they did. It's that the universe. Universe is just that trivial. It just is not important. What's important is spiritual growth, period, because that's why we're here.
I honestly have to agree with you on that. Since I was 17 and began what I called my search, and I continue, it's always intrigued me, both the people that I have come across and had an opportunity to talk with, and the books that I've read. Workshops and seminars and all the different things that are out there. I'm always intrigued by the position, the philosophical position that people take that is not dogmatic. That is, this is where I am. And for that matter, they say, and this is where I am today.
Yes.
I may not be here tomorrow.
To learn and grow. Yeah. Absolutely right.
And
so
that
right.
has always fascinated me. I've never latched on to one particular philosophy or teacher or guru or what have you. Mm-hmm. And I've met a lot of people who have, and I sometimes wonder, what am I missing out on? Why am I not connecting, you know?
You're not missing out on anything.
Yeah.
It's between, one of the things Jesus came to do was to teach us to relate to God directly. Go into your room, speak to God in secret, and the God who sees in secret will hear you.
Yeah.
He was trying to teach us that we don't need anybody in the way, and in fact, to have anyone in the way is counterproductive, because your mind is part of God. You are as close to God right now as you could possibly be. So to put a guru in between, or to put a religion or anything in between, is actually counterproductive.
Yeah. I do like what the Baha'is say, their founder Baha'u'llah said, that if you reject one of the messengers of God, you reject them all. And if you accept one of the messengers of God, you accept them all. Ergo, what you're just saying is quite true, that it's universal, and it doesn't matter
Jesus
who's
said
bringing
the
message.
Thing, and
yeah.
which the Christians don't pay attention to. John, his closest friend among his disciples, said to him, you know, Master, we found someone who's casting out demons, but he's not doing it in your name. We've got a problem. We can't make him stop. And Jesus said, don't stop him. Whoever is not against us is for us.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I thank you so much for coming in studio and sharing with us here on the program. This has been truly fascinating. I have thoroughly enjoyed this.
Oh, I've enjoyed it too.
This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really is. Thank you so much, Richard.
You're very welcome. And I hope that the next time you come into town, we'll do this again.
Absolutely right.
I do want to let our listeners know that you can hear this entire interview. Just go to richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and the play button associated with Roberta Grimes, and her link to her website will be there too. And I think that we should be giving that out as well. What is that website?
It's easy. It's robertagrimes.com.
I thought so.
I have smart children who did that soon enough that I got the name.
Very good. I managed to grab mine too. RobertaGrimes.com is the website, and a number of different books. And you, before we wrap it up, you said that you are working on another.
The third book in the Fun Trilogy is The Fun of Growing Forever, and it will show how to use the teachings of Jesus to grow spiritually. Again, nothing to do with religion, and how we will be able to transform the world once enough of us have done this.
Oh, very cool. Well, we'll look forward to that. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.